This week on the Barrag World Show, we talk Brexit, technological choices, co-creation, and more. This week's show is sponsored by Videoblocks and Mighty Deal. BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show is, are you ready for this? Marcus Lillington, Rachel Andrew, Dan Edwards and Sam Barnes. Hello all.
Hello, hello.
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 Hey, all those people. That's so exciting. So we're doing something a little bit different this season of the podcast. Welcome back to the new season of the show, I should say. Mm-hmm. We are going to do something a little bit different. We're going to try a new technique. We're going to have a round table discussion with five of us on the show. What could possibly go wrong?
Everything.
Well, yes, quite apparently. If we manage to make this through this show without anyone dropping out or anything going wrong, that would be pretty impressive. So what we're going to do is we're going to... each week we're going to have somebody, a group of people come along and that group of people are going to represent different aspects of digital design and development and strategy. So we've got Marcus that's going to kind of cover the kind of agency salesy side of things. Is that fair to say, Marcus?
I think certainly for maybe the first two shows I might be able to keep to that, yeah.
And then you'll be talking about cricket.
Cricket, guitars. I really want to buy a pedal steel guitar, so I've got to talk about that at some point.
Okay, we'll get that. And then, Rachel, you're going to be talking about what, development and startup culture-y kind of stuff?
Yeah, I guess so, something like that.
You don't know, do you? No
yeah,
idea.
I'm just going to talk about stuff that happens to cross my brain during the week.
That pretty much sums up what we've been doing for the last 10 years, so that works out well. So then we've got Dan. Now, Dan, you and Andy are going to kind of take it in turns and do various things because Andy Clark is traveling the world at the moment and you're kicking off for him. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and I'm not going anywhere, so I'm just here.
So you're just here and you're going to be talking about designy related stuff
is correct, yeah.
And then finally, we've got Sam Barnes. Hello, Sam.
Hello, Paul.
And what contribution are you going to make to all of this?
So I'll be looking at it from a sort of project management delivery kind of background, I guess.
Okay, which is great.
So and then, you had the opportunity there to say the best. I'll be the best one of the group.
I won't tell you what went through my head. That was the pause.
But then, of course, the big question is, what do I bring to the table? I'll talk about kind of, I don't know, strategy stuff, I guess. I really should have put some thought into that. So that's the idea. So hopefully every show there's going to be something for everyone, which will be very, very nice. And we're going to go around the table. Let's actually start off by doing that very quickly and go around the table and just say, if you wouldn't mind, a little bit about yourself and, you know, what kind of stuff that you do and things like that. So, Dan, tell people a bit about you and your background.
Okay, so I'm the creative director at No Divide, which basically just means I design stuff half the time, or a little bit more than half the time, and the rest of the time spend doing businessy stuff around the agency. I've started that with Ryan Taylor, a friend of mine, coming up for 2 years in November, and we're a small digital agency, and yeah, I'd say my time is basically spent doing visual design and stuff, and then sort of trying to run a business at the same time. And just trying to juggle
really
those
well.
Things.
Yeah. So, Rachel, what about you? You tell us a bit about your background and what you're doing these days.
Well, I'm one half of a company, and really what we do these days is we have a product called Perch, which is a content management system. So I run that company with my husband, Drew McClellan. And when I'm not doing that, I'm an invited expert to the CSS Working Group. And I sort of wander around the world talking about stuff, mostly at the moment, CSS and CSS for layout.
I love the way wander around the world. I've just got this image of you randomly walking into bars and things and starting to talk about CSS layout.
That's pretty much what it's like.
It probably is, actually, now I think about it. Sam, what are you doing these days? You've moved recently, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, so I'm now an engineering manager at Marks & Spencer's. Been there about 4 months now. I've got the background in project management and a teeny bit of front-end development, but really my job right now, I think we said it last time I was on the show, I think my job is line management and what it sounds like, but really just sorting stuff out, whatever it might be. Seeing what stuff's coming, trying to avoid it, and if it hits, trying to sort it out.
Marcus, I know we've been doing this for years, but there might be people that are listening to the show that don't know us. So what about you? How would you describe what you do these days?
Quite similar to Dan, apart from the designy bit. Half my time is spent doing kind of businessy sales type stuff, writing proposals, attending pitches, that kind of thing. But I spend the other half of my time, it seems, doing more and more consultancy type work where we will help our clients work out who they are and who they do stuff for. So I write a lot of documents and I do a lot of workshops where I bully people and make them decide on things and that kind of thing. So yeah, very much a kind of 50-50, one side consulting, one side trying to get business for Headscape. And Headscape's been going for nearly 15 years now.
That's scary, isn't it? Wow. So, and as for me, I'm a independent user experience consultant and do a lot with digital transformation as well. So we've got a nice mix, actually, of different people. We're a bit like, we could do with a content person is what we could really do with. But I'll have to work on that for future seasons.
Why don't you just pretend to be a content person, Paul?
I pretend to be all kinds of things.
That's why I asked.
Yeah, I could do that.
Surely,
I could.
Surely we've all pretended at one point to be a content person.
This is very true, Sam. Yes. Okay, so that's the team. That's the group of people that are going to be covering different things. We're going to get into different discussions in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to quickly talk about our first sponsor of the day, which is Mighty Deals, which is a daily deals website aimed at creative professionals. They offer a whole range of different deals on things like fonts, templates, apps, ebooks, icons, and loads of other stuff. So recently, I'm producing a set of tip cards, advice cards, and I needed a nice set of illustrations, and so I picked them up on Mighty Deal, which worked really well, actually. Deadly cheap, which is great. Discounts usually range between 50% and 97% off. You think 97%, that's a very specific percentage there, isn't it? And they're available for a limited time only. They focus on products and services for web designers and developers, really. So, for example, the illustrations I mentioned for those cards. And then while other sites may offer you the option to download those files, for an extra fee, because you know what happens, right? This is what happens to me, is I buy things like this on these sites and then I lose them. I want to get them again. And a lot of sites, you can't do that, but Mighty Deals will keep everything for you, all nicely organized, so you can go back and get your hands on it anytime you want to in the future. So it's quite a nice way of buying these different things because it's all held together and managed. And also they've got a great 30-day full refund place. So go along and check them out. See what they've got to offer. They've got loads of stuff. If you use a coupon code of BOAGWORLD15, you'll get 15% off of all of the deals that they've got on their website, which is pretty good. So on top of the deals that they're currently offering, you can get an additional 15% off, which is pretty good. So check them out at Mighty Deals. So that's them, which is good. Let's then move on to our discussion. So the way that this is going to work is different people are going to come along and talk about whatever it is that they're into at any particular time. And Marcus, I think if it's okay, you'll kick us off. Now, you wanted to talk about Brexit.
Yeah, for that fun subject.
Yeah,
something nice and lightweight to start us off, as Dan pointed out the other day. It was the biggest talking point, I think, possibly of our lives. And I think it still continues to be, maybe not quite as much as it was before the vote, but it still continues to be. And I just thought, it might be an interesting thing to discuss today. Has the decision to leave the EU, even though it hasn't happened yet, changed our businesses? But I thought I'd start off by saying that I suspect we all voted the same way, i.e. to stay in. Please shout if not. But my reasons for staying in weren't particularly financial. I always thought, I didn't think that we would necessarily, as a country, kind of go down the pan financially if we left. Didn't know, really. But my reasons were more kind of, I want to be a world citizen, and I felt that kind of leaving Europe was a step in the wrong direction from that point of view. So it was never really a kind of financial thing with me. But I've got some intelligent friends who remain convinced that the right decision was made, that the EU was rotten to the core, that it was full of unelected bureaucrats, it was very wasteful, etc., etc. And as I said before, it doesn't seem to have changed much from us from a business point of view. I guess from an opportunities point of view is where I'm coming from. It's not like suddenly everything's dried up and we're kind of searching for work. So I would just be interested to hear what other people, particularly, I guess, Dan and Rachel, whether they feel that things have changed a lot since the vote to leave happened, because it doesn't really seem to have changed much for us. I still think we shouldn't have done, for the reasons I mentioned before, but sort of financially, it doesn't seem to have changed much. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, well, it immediately made a difference to us because we essentially set our, when we sell licenses of Perch, we basically set our exchange rate against GBP because we're based in the UK. So that's our kind of main currency. And I think just under half of purchases at the moment are GBP.
Right.
So what we do is what we don't want to do with Perch is to have a constantly fluctuating exchange rate. So if you come along and buy Perch in dollars, we set that rate. So we look at the GBP rate, we do a conversion, and we set that rate. So we kind of swallow the exchange gain or loss, basically. We don't ask the web designer who might be quoting for a project to do that. So the day that Brexit happened, we were looking at this, and I kept like refreshing XE.com. As it happens, I actually spoke to some people who work at XE.com when I was at Event Apart last week, and they said that the site crashed on Brexit Day because so many people were looking up exchange rates. Mm. So, so I was looking at this and we realised that, this was going to hang around, this the weakening pound, and it actually made Perch way too expensive in US dollars or euros compared to what you would charge in GBP. And we didn't want people to have to pay in GBP to get the best deal sort of thing, because then they get hit by charges at their bank sometimes. So we actually reduced the costs for American and European purchasers, which is great for them. But it was kind of this obvious thing where we could see the impact, this immediate impact, that we were knocking this huge amount of money off the price for people in those currencies. So that was kind of one thing. And I think in terms of the impact, it's possibly a little early to tell, but we tend to see when the kind of industry is doing poorly or doing well by the number of Perch licenses that get bought.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, because all of our customers are web designers, and typically are small agencies and freelancers and things like that. And I say small, I mean, we've got some reasonably big agencies who use Perch, but they're doing sites for clients. And that's, we don't sell this to kind of end users, businesses wanting to create their own websites. We sell it to web designers. So typically, if things are a bit quiet for us, we can kind of track it back, and we're talking to people, we talk to customers, they're like, oh yeah, we've had a really quiet 2 months. And so we actually start to see those things playing out. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next few months. And what our sort of split of customers ends up like. Will we end up with more American and European customers just because actually the UK is dropping off slightly?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, it's actually worked quite well for me at the moment, bizarrely, because I have a fair number of clients who pay in US dollars. And so as a result, I'm doing fairly well, thank you very much, out of it. But you don't want a scenario where the pound is as weak as it is at the moment.
No, it's horrendously expensive. So because I'm traveling to the States a lot for conferences, and it is just, I was just doing my expenses when I got back, and it, you know, really makes a huge difference. You're looking at, you know, those receipts for eating out or whatever that you have to do when you're traveling. You know, realizing
it's at a 30-year low, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, it's incredibly expensive now to be in the States.
So what we really want from a British point of view is Trump to get into power, which would cause the US dollar to crash, and that would level things back out again. See, everybody's lives to be equally ruined globally.
Yeah, that seems to be the way things are going. So hey,
one of the things when this originally happened, Rachel, you were quite vocal as a number of people were. Thankfully, we don't have Andy Clark on the show, who's still very vocal about this particular subject. But you half talked about the idea of potentially moving to Ireland or Germany or somewhere like that. Have you had any more thoughts about that?
Yeah, that we're intending to move the business to Ireland. Yeah, I've had some advice on it. It's relatively straightforward to move a sort of a digital business, because really it doesn't actually matter where we're headquartered, so to speak. To get to Dublin takes me less time than it takes to get to London, because we're right near Bristol Airport, you know, and hop in an EasyJet or whatever and be in Dublin in very little time. So, you know, there are various rules around it. You've got to have a director who's living in Ireland, but that can be essentially, you know, your accountant can take on that sort of role in the business. The sort of company law is very similar, and obviously it's European law, which I'm used to dealing with. And we're going to have to deal with anyway, even out of the EU. We're still going to have to comply with all the VAT rules, with things like the data protection stuff. We're still going to have to deal with that if we want to sell into Europe. So as far as I'm concerned, I'd rather have the company based in a legal system that I understand. That it's based on things that I understand, and also not be tied to a currency which I can't see improving anytime soon.
Yeah. Dan, what about from your point of view? I mean, have you noticed any effect on your workload, do you think?
I think it's caused uncertainty. So I can't say that we've noticed that literally overnight people stopped inquiring. I mean, it's been slow. Like since the weeks, sort of a couple of weeks before Brexit and since, it's been slower. It only really seems like literally this month, so October, that things have started, you know, potential clients and, you know, have started to maybe resurface a little bit. And I don't know whether that's an exact reflection on Brexit and, you know, it's directly related. It's so hard to say because nobody comes along and says to you, are we going to pause this project because of Brexit, or you know, we're not looking right now because of Brexit? It's not been the right time for a lot of people. As I say, whether that's a reflection on Brexit or us, or just, you know, a point in time, I don't know. I think the one thing it has definitely done is caused uncertainty, and all the time, you know, the pound is fluctuating, and you know, we're not sure when Brexit's going to happen and what the exact reaction is going to be for small businesses, larger businesses, etc. It brings unnecessary uncertainty, is what I'd say, you know, for people. And you know, that's going to be a shame for businesses all over the place, you know, people not buying houses or buying cars or things like that. You know, I'm sure in other industries there have been a, you know, in certain places, maybe more so than others, you know, slowing down in their industries because of an uncertainty. I don't have any less or any more money because of it. But you know, my reasons were for very much the same as Marcus's for leaving. And I just think it's a shame that it's kind of brought that divide and that uncertainty to the country.
One of the things that really annoys me is we'll never really know whether we're better off or worse off. It's just kind of, you can't measure, we won't be able to measure how we're doing against something that doesn't exist anymore. So it's kind of
exactly. Really, which is always going to, it's always going to be tricky, isn't it? You know, if we ended up staying and then things went bad, that would have been, you know, we'd have ended up having the same discussions again about, well, that if we had left, you know, it would have been better, or if things got better because we stayed. They could have said it could be even better if we'd left, and you know, vice versa. We'll likely say, well, it's bad because we've left, and other people say, well, we don't know. It's so hard to say, like you say.
So we need a vote on an A-B test, is what you say.
Yeah, A-B testing. That's what we need to be able to do, multivariate testing on reality. Also, a control Z for real life would be useful as well.
Yes.
That's the other thing that I think life is really missing.
Yeah, or a mute button for certain politicians.
Yeah, that would be good as well. Yeah, I'm liking all of these ideas. Talking of new ideas, let's move on to our second discussion point. It's going to be fast and furious. Brexit, we've done it now. That's sorted. We've said our piece on that. We're going to now move on. Sam,
yeah.
Have you got something cheerful and upbeat to talk to us about, or are you going to be equally as miserable as Marcus?
I don't know about cheerful and upbeat. I'll just lay it out there. You can decide.
Okay.
So I thought, with the one of the most prestigious digital project management conferences about to kick off in San Antonio in Texas, this is a community that's just sort of growing and growing, has been over the last few years. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting to see a tweet from Andy Budd, which was a quote from Jeff Gothelf's talk at Mind the Product London event. Mm-hmm. So I'll read the tweet for you. It says, project managers, scrum masters and business analysts, are these roles you continue to need with continuous learning? You know, obviously I wasn't at the event and I haven't seen Jeff's talk, but I think it does raise a really interesting topic. So I'll just sort of clarify what I read from this and put it forward for discussion, really. So I think what he was probably getting at is, if you've got a cross-functional team that becomes incredibly high-performing and thus by default fantastic at continuous learning, you know, is there a way you can see them becoming less dependent on project managers, scrum masters, business analysts and people like that, to the point where they no longer need them at all? And I've obviously got my own thoughts on this, but I'd be absolutely fascinated to hear what everyone else thinks of this before I offer those up.
Well,
indeed.
Yeah, that's a bit out of the blue. I think project managers are probably the most, I was going to say the most valuable members of a team, but no, of course they're not. But they are very, you know, we couldn't function without a project manager in our team. And we've got very highly skilled people who, you know, who are really good at their job and get on with it without necessarily being told this is what you need to do every minute of the day. But we would still struggle massively. So from a personal point of view, I think they're very necessary.
Yeah, I mean, I'd kind of echoing you, I guess, a bit, Marcus, in that, you know, we started not that long ago as an agency, and, you know, the first four people were all creative. So whether that's, you know, front end, back end design, etc., just in the creative area. It wasn't until we hired our fifth person that we actually got our first project manager. And it was immediately obvious we were doing a lot of things wrong. You know, whether it was just to the way that we managed our time and being aware of that, like, oh, by the way, you've run over this, you know, maybe we should be time tracking it better or whatever, or the way we handled potential clients coming in, or the way we dealt with current clients, you know, not communicating properly. All of those things were highlighted and more when we got our first project manager. And, you know, although we've scaled back the company to four now, we still have kept one of our project managers, and we will always have, fingers crossed, we will always have a project manager as part of No Divide, because I just don't see how, especially as we grow, how we can really expect to do all that ourselves. Now, our roles have had to change a little bit as a creative, and especially myself and Ryan being creative and technical directors, we've had to kind of take on some of the admin. But that's fine, but it's not the main thing that we do. You know, having a project manager allows us to focus more on what it is that motivates us ourselves, and also the stuff that we're actually really good at.
We had a when Paul abandoned us.
I think you mean couldn't hack it anymore.
Oh yeah, that's the one. Yes, yes. Well, he couldn't. It was too hot for him in the kitchen. We had 6 months without a project manager, which was just a nightmare. I had to do project management, and I'm not very good at it.
That makes it sound like I used to be a project manager. which is so not true of any sense of the word.
Yeah, but we're just the point is, it was, you know, we decided back then that we didn't want to get any bigger. We are very happy at the size we are now. We were nearly twice the size 5 years ago, and we didn't like that for many reasons when we were a bigger company. But we had to get a project manager in. It was just like, you know, even though it was obviously there's an expense involved in employing somebody else, it was just a no brainer for us. And just going back to the specific point, I think, okay, if you've got this fantastic team that's, you know, super efficient and, you know, knows each other inside out, what happens if somebody leaves and you have to get a new member of the team?
Good point.
Or, you know, a really junior person joins or something like that. Having somebody who's managing the people and managaging the project, I think, well, I've already said it, I think they're worth their weight in gold.
Do you think, mine, this is maybe a reflection on the type of scenario we're talking about? It was Jeff, wasn't it?
You said exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether Jeff, you know, is thinking about an in-house team working on a product on an ongoing basis. I mean, one of the big reasons why, say, you know, Headscape or No Divide needs a project manager so much is because of that client interaction and the customer service that goes with looking after a client, and the fact that that client is an integral part of the team, but they're kind of outside of the team and don't know the process, etc. So, I mean, does that make a difference? Or, you know, I mean, Sam, you work in-house.
Yeah.
You tell me.
Well, I've worked sort of agency, small agency, medium, and now sort of large in-house. So exactly what I think about it. It all depends on the context. So this kind of quote, I mean, kind of reminded me of many, many years ago when we had to kind of start to design in the browser mantra going around. And while it was, the benefits of that were really clearly communicated, and it obviously sounded just you know, highly efficient compared to the other version. When you were actually at an agency and you had a designer and a front end developer at the time, and they couldn't do each other's job all the time, it kind of felt like a viewpoint from a very specific standpoint. And that standpoint being kind of what Marcus said, I think, when you've got really, really highly skilled people, multi-talented, which is great, but it's not too common. In terms of the agency and in-house, that does make a difference. I think if you're in-house, it's a little bit easier to take that on than working with external clients. I think an answer that would encapsulate all scenarios, I think, is that I don't think we're being close to being able to dump these roles yet. But I think it's a kind of an admirable aim. You know, so instead of dumping the roles, I kind of thought we should be, you know, aiming at dumping the need for one person to do those roles within that team. So, you know, we should be including those roles in the phrase cross-functional, perhaps, getting people working on production areas. You know, people like project managers will often start with manual testing. QAs, you know, anyone can do manual testing with a bit of training, bit of support. And it just got me thinking about, you know, can we get some production folk into the more businessy side of stuff as part of a scrum team? So not, you know, massively, just tiny bits of exposure here and there. So actually kind of reversing it, really, and having everyone understanding each other's world a little bit more. I think that would only really result in good things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true. The kind of having a better understanding of how different people in your team works. I think we can be terrible at that. Rachel, I'm quite interested in Perch, because it's just, you know, you and Drew. You've obviously got a roadmap for development. You're dealing with, you know, bug reports and all kinds of, so there's quite an overhead of project managey stuff. Is that something you do? Is it something Drew does? Is it formalized? How do you deal with project management?
I think there is definitely a difference between, doing work for clients and having a product that you're essentially working on all the time. I would love to have some sort of project management here that would take that role from me, really.
Right.
I think, you know, in an ideal world, if we could, you know, if we sort of were in a position to afford that, I think it would be a useful role, partly because when there's just two of you, in any kind of small team, I think, there's that thing where you spend quite a bit of time going, oh, what are you doing? And that can come across as being a bit like, are you doing anything? do you know what I mean? If you're trying to do that kind of checking in, especially with the amount of travel I do. And I think it's easy to sort of end up quite siloed, especially when there's, you know, just a few of you and you're sort of doing your roles and just getting on with it. And there's that sort of temptation to say, well, these are my bits. These are the bits I do. And we're very much like that here. You know, there are the things that Drew does, there's the things that I do. And sometimes it feels a bit like, you know, they don't meet in the middle because we're sort of so busy getting on with them. And I think that that role, that sort of project management role, can be very good at bringing together that stuff and making sure that things happen at the times they're supposed to happen. Because if you've got a small team and people work very independently of each other, there's kind of that point where, you know, that work has to come together. You know, we launch a new feature for Perch, then it probably needs, you know, some demo videos. It needs documentation. It needs the marketing piece, you know, all the stuff we're going to put on the website. We need to sort of coordinate when we're going to announce things. And then obviously there's all the actual code that needs to be written to build that feature. And we can kind of end up doing those things out of sync. And so, you know, there are definitely days where I think it would be great to have somebody who had that in their head. You know, when is that happening? And, you know, so that would be a useful thing. And so I can certainly see a time, particularly, you know, if we get, we would love to have another developer here. And I think it then starts to become more useful because people just end up waiting for each other. If you don't have someone with that role, someone has to take on that role, whether they're officially the project manager or not. You know, someone has to do that.
Yeah. Okay, that's great, Sam. Thank you very much. We need to move on. I need to get used to the timing of this. We're trying to cover quite a lot in the show, aren't we? And I need to move faster. Dan, no pressure on you now. We've got to sort out creativity versus efficiency in the next few minutes. Go.
Okay.
So what did you said you wanted to talk about this idea of whether our drive towards efficiency is undermining creativity. Is that right?
Yeah, to a certain extent. It's basically been something I've been talking about over the last couple of months. So I wrote a talk and I've given it a couple of times. And it seems to spark a bit of interest amongst people. It certainly was an interesting topic for me, which is obviously why I chose it. It's essentially this idea of this thought that we're kind of, it seems to be every time there's a new tool or a new framework or a new something shiny to try out, that it seems to be the focus is less on this allows you to make something that's going to produce a better visual or more of a creative solution, and more that this is going to allow you to make something quicker. So whether that is a framework, you know, just to bring up one, obviously Bootstrap or Foundation or any of these kind of things. Obviously there's thousands that you could mention, but you know, they're there to sort of aid us in terms of being able to build out ideas quickly, you know, which I'm not saying I'm against. You know, I work with companies and we try to advocate for, you know, working to an MVP and, you know, getting things out quickly and iterating upon them. So it's not so much that I have the issue with, but more the fact that we're almost sidelining the aesthetic and the creative direction of websites and apps a little bit more. You know, which obviously leads us to this whole, you know, the web, all websites look the same kind of thing that happens more and more. You know, we see it all the time, people talking about it, saying everything looks the same. And I do wonder whether that's because, you know, we're sort of building tools that allow us to be quicker and more efficient and, you know, have to deal with all the complexities of the web, you know, whether that's responsive design or, you know, cross browsers or, you know, teams working in multiple locations, whatever they are there. It definitely seems to be this kind of underlying idea of being incredibly efficient and getting things out quickly. And I guess it's more of a concern, really. And it seems to be one that other people have where essentially designers aren't maybe doing the things that, you know, they get in excited or motivated by as much. And especially since we've been moving to more designing in the browser, maybe, you know, we're getting into the browser quicker. And again, it's about getting something out quicker and being more efficient. And, you know, to everything I say, there's obviously a counter argument, right? You know, every time, you know, we take a forward step with, you know, designing in the browser is something that's great and it makes sense because it's where the end product is going to be. But at the same time, are we then simply just jumping to that because it seems like the quickest way to get it out, rather than thinking about what the problem is, or what the goals are, or the visual design, or what the brand actually stands for.
Rachel, you know, with Perch, you've built a product that is designed to make things quicker and simpler and easier for people. So I'm imagining you've got a perspective on this.
I've got all the perspectives on this from various angles. So, I mean, with Perch, we specifically don't dictate how things look. And that's always been a kind of thing behind Perch, is that it doesn't come with any themes. You know, we don't say, oh, you have to output this markup even. You know, you can use Perch to just output JSON if you wanted to. You don't even need to output HTML. So we very specifically try not to dictate the way things look. There is a good chunk of our customer base who would love it if we did. You know, would love it if it kind of just came packaged as something they could just tweak the colours of. We kind of push back against that all the time, because what we don't want is people just sort of downloading this thing, tweaking the colours, and, oh, you can tell that's a Perch site. People want that. People would love to have a lot of those decisions made. And I think that a lot of the time is why people are using a lot of the tooling and frameworks and so on. And I say this as a non-designer. It's very, very nice to have some sort of front-end framework that makes good decisions for me. You know, I install something and I, you know, sort of start laying things out, and I, you know, make a form, and the form looks nice and it's sort of quite usable. And I think, yeah, that's great, because I'm not having to make those decisions, which is useful, and it lets me get something built quickly. You know, we used Foundation for all of our documentation recently, because it meant I could concentrate on writing documentation rather than trying to make it look good. But you get to this point, I think, where, yeah, everything starts to look the same. You get sites that look like Bootstrap that aren't even Bootstrap. because people, it's like, oh, well, everything needs to have this big sort of panel at the top with the big text in, and you know, and that's a real shame. And as someone who cares about the future of sort of open web standards, and I work with the CSS Working Group and so on, you're trying to get people excited about new layout methods that are going to open up all sorts of possibilities for creativity. And all they're asking me is, oh, can I replicate the Bootstrap grid with this? And I think that's such a shame. You know, people aren't looking at this new stuff and saying, oh, wow, it's going to enable all this really cool, interesting stuff and things that get us away from the sort of real boxiness of the web and so on. And they're not. They're just thinking, well, how do we do a 12-column flexible grid? That's it. So that's sort of a shame. It starts people pushing the boundaries of the technology.
Sam, what are your feelings on this? As, you know, from a project management point of view, surely you just want everything to be as efficient and quick as possible.
Well, I was thinking that when I heard the topic. It's like you're talking to someone with PM in his blood here, so it's a bit of a meaty one for me.
Yeah.
You know, this is like what many PMs out there and a lot of business people will face on a daily basis with teams.
Sorry to interrupt you, Sam, but this sounds like just designers having a whinge, doesn't it?
Well, not really. I think that there's a way to find out. You can filter it out. So one approach I would use very, very briefly, I came from developing front end quite full time commercially, and then I moved into project management, and I still remember today the first time as a project manager that I was given an answer, a timeline by a developer, and I actually uttered the words, "Can't you just code it dirty?" And I remember that, you know, to this day, because I realized that I've just become what I thought I hated. The fact of the matter is, I just had more information. And so what I realized then, and what I've done ever since, and it seems to work, and again, it filters out the people that are kind of just moaning, is I will take, as a project manager or anyone leading teams, really, when those compromises need to be made for commercial reasons, I'll actually sit down with those people, sit down with the team and explain, you know, all of the variables, all of the reasons that I'm coming to that decision. The fact that I know what good looks like, and yet I'm making this decision. There are reasons for that. I think a lot of people who are, you know, in positions of authority over production teams, and I've heard this said myself, and it kind of annoys me a lot. They will say things like, you know, or they, you know, production teams wouldn't understand or they don't care about that side of the project, which just isn't true. Isn't true. It's insulting. So if you actually sit down with these very, very smart people and actually take the time to explain why you're making the decisions that you are, tell them all the variables. What you're really looking for is a face that kind of at the beginning resembles contempt, changing to something that looks a little bit more like understanding. And they can see, actually, you know, with all these things in play, I can kind of see why you're doing it. So on one hand, if someone won't sit with you and listen and try to understand this stuff, and I think it does border on a little bit of whinging. And likewise, when it comes to the teams, I think you have to bear in mind, you know, what the teams have been, or teams or individuals for that matter, have been working on. So when you've got a team or individual that have had to compromise recently on a project and kind of do that kind of work, I think as a team leader or even project manager, you need to make a mental note of that. And if it looks like they're going to get that again and again, you kind of need to address that rather than just focus on deliver. You know, you need to think about people's happiness at work as well.
I mean, Dan, you've got to deal with all of those issues that Sam's just outlined because you run your own agency. So on one hand, you have to keep your other creatives happy and keep them engaged with the work that's being produced. But on the other hand, you do have to deliver within budget and on time, and clients can't always justify spending a lot of time and money on a pretty design where a bootstrap design would achieve the same return on investment from them. Isn't that the difference between design and art, for example? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. It is a really tricky one. I mean, in terms of the benefits for us as a team and the benefits for the client, my argument would always be that, obviously, yes, internally you want people to be happy about what they're producing, and allowing them to maybe be a bit more creative or look at things differently is going to help with that. But also it is going to help the client, because ultimately, you know, you standing out from the competition or, you know, actually taking more time to solve the problem with maybe something that requires more consideration, more thought, is going to end up with a better product. Like, yes, a bootstrap theme will work absolutely fine. It will solve a problem, but will it solve your specific problem? And more importantly, are you telling your customers what you want them to feel and what you want them to do when they get there? Like, the reason certain brands do so well is because, you know, you can look at them and immediately get a feel of what it is that they stand for, what it is they want you to feel. And I think that is the part that seems to be forgotten. It's not really, yeah, we can get a website out very quickly, but what is it that actually we want to create here? Is it, you know, as part of this, you know, when we're creating a brand and we're, you know, building an experience, like, people are going to come to your site or use your app and they're going to experience something. And through really good design, and it's not just about making it, obviously, you know, prettier. I'm not necessarily just saying that, but it's also about actually thinking more creatively about the problem rather than, you know, for example, should something be a button? Now, it just because it's a link to somewhere doesn't mean it needs to be a button. It kind of depends on what the action is. Does something need to be a calendar, when actually that might work better in a list view? It's kind of like asking these questions. And just because we've got components that we've built out and it's like, well, we'll just drop a button there because it's a link, or, well, it's a date picker, so we'll use a calendar. Well, does that make sense in the context of what you're actually building here? Mm. And I think those are the questions that we maybe don't spend as much time considering. And I think that, you know, when it comes to teams, internal, remote, you know, and bringing your clients in and all those kind of things, I think it is about bringing in that kind of diverse opinion, bringing in people like the CEO of the company who's been there 15 years. You know, why did he start this? What does it stand for? You know, and also bringing in project managers, designers, developers, content people, getting all those various ideas and maybe thinking a bit more, you know, to use a buzzword, out the box, about, you know, how are we going to solve this problem? And all of these things, yes, they're harder to sell to a client because they take more time. But ultimately, if you can get them in and actually discover and work out the problem with you, you're going to end up with a better result. And also they're going to be a lot happier because they feel like they've got something that they're actually paying for. At the end of the day, you know, we're not cheap. You know, there's a lot of people that do things cheap. I'd like to think that, you know, most agencies and freelancers, then we're not cheap. We're not a cheap service. You know, we're professionals. And so if people are coming to us to hire us for that thing, I'd like to think that, you know, we can fairly easily, you know, sell them on exactly why we are going to do all this stuff and why we're going to spend more time doing it. And, you know, that's up to us to do, you know, that's part of our job as designers, developers, project managers, etc.
In an ideal world, these kinds of frameworks and tools, they should allow you to spend more time on that kind of creative stuff rather than less, because a lot of the underlying, you know, nitty gritty boring work is done for you. It's like nobody builds a content management system anymore. You just buy in a content management system that is right for your needs, you know, and then you, that allows you to focus more on what matters rather than spending all that time creating the underlying content management system. And the same could be true for a framework as well. It just all depends on whether you know, how that extra time is then spent. Is it spent on doing those kind of creative things that improve the brand and the identity and the way you communicate with the clients? Or are you then just using that as a cost saving to be able to reduce your costs? And that, I guess, is the fundamental issue, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, very quickly, because I know we want to finish this section, but yeah, that is the problem. You know, I think ultimately people are looking at, right, well, how can we kind of churn out the same thing quickly, make more profit, and, you know, ultimately all move on with our lives and just, you know, and I think if that is the attitude, you're always going to just stand on these tools as, you know, a way to just make more profit.
Yeah.
That's not why people created them. You know, I'm sure, I mean, the reason we created, for example, Astrum, which is our pattern library generator, is because we needed it internally. Now, you could easily use that and it would cut out a big part of the project that you're maybe working on, but that's not why we created it. And I'm sure the people that created Bootstrap and Foundation and all these other frameworks and tools have not done it to simply allow you to, you know, make more profit quickly by quickly generating out same designs, right? It's but it's like with great power comes great responsibility, right? We have to manage our responsibility with these tools and, you know, be sure, like you say, why are we using them, and, you know, how can we ensure we're spending our time correctly?
Mm. Talking of tools, that brings us nicely on to Rachel's segment, which I think we'll do as the last one this week, and we'll save mine for another time. Because you tweeted a really interesting thing, Rachel, that got my attention and a lot of people's attention, interestingly. You were talking about technology shaming,
yeah,
which is a very interesting idea. Do you want to explain what you were getting at?
Okay, so, well, I sort of tweeted, is this thing, you know, I put all this stuff out on Twitter, which is perfectly sensible, and no one retweets it. And then you kind of make an offhand comment. And mine was, oh, look, someone else mocking PHP developers. I'd respond, but I've got this successful business with a product written in PHP to run. And the kind of thing behind it, I'd seen a couple of things. It wasn't actually one specific thing. There was a couple of things floating around over the last week. And the sort of standard thing, you know, you mentioned PHP and everyone's like, oh, PHP, yeah. And I was sort of thinking this, actually, you know, how many, you know, projects and great products and things that we use every day are actually written in PHP, and how many people are PHP developers, or, you know, that, oh, that's a big chunk of what they do. And this kind of thing where you mention what you do and then half the internet turns around and has a laugh at you.
Yeah.
Is thoroughly miserable, because the thing is, the technology isn't everything that makes the project, you know, the technology choice. I mean, you know, as the owner of a product that is written in PHP, which Perch is, we launched Perch 7 years ago. PHP was essentially the only thing we could build it in that would have support, because it's self-hosted. People mm-hmm. need to be able to install it on their servers. And what's on all the servers? PHP.
Yeah.
So, and it's still the case now. 7 years on, it's not even like, you know, there's something else come along and we need to think, oh, maybe we ought to rewrite this thing because this other thing is now on all the servers. It's not the case. You know, PHP is still on all the servers of the sort of people who use Perch. You know, just as it's on the servers of all the people who use WordPress.
So why do you think people get so opinionated about, you know, things like languages, you know, or frameworks or any of this stuff? It's like everybody seems to have an opinion on it.
Well, I think partly it's this whole new shiny object syndrome thing, you know, right. So people are constantly looking for a new thing to talk about online, because obviously that, you know, gets eyeballs on you if you're talking about something cool and interesting. And that's fine. You know, I like new stuff as much as the next person. But I think the problem with this is that if you start saying to people, you know, they say, oh, I write PHP. And we're like, oh, do you? Oh, you know, you should be using Python. You should be using Ruby or whatever it is. You know, you should be using Node. You're making them feel bad about the thing that they know how to do. And potentially what that sort of does to people is they then end up running around learning like the next thing and then the next thing and the next thing and using it and never getting any deep knowledge of any technology because they're so busy flitting to the thing that all the cool people are saying is the next thing to use. And, you know, it's fine if you're me and you've been doing this forever and someone says, oh, PHP, and you go, fine, whatever. carry on writing PHP because that's what we do. But if you're new to this or you're less experienced or, you know, you're just not very confident in the choices of the things that you're using, it can cause people just to get, well, just get more wound up in this kind of panic that they need to know everything. And, you know, if people are sort of being, I don't know, sort of pointing the finger at the choices. And you could say that on the, you know, the front end as well. You know, people saying, oh, you're still using Grunt. You know, everybody's moved on to, you know, and it's like, it doesn't matter. The client doesn't mind. And in the case of server-side languages, you know, the web browser doesn't mind what you use to build your website. You know, what gets HTML and CSS to the browser. It doesn't matter what that is. So, you know, you're kind of looking at the wrong thing. We should be just solving problems well. It doesn't really matter what the technology is that we're using to do that.
Sam, from a project management point of view, you know, this must be a frustration for you when developers kind of going, oh, we should be using this now or, you know.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, don't get me wrong. This isn't just isolated to technology either. You know, you've only got to mention Waterfall Agile and you've got exactly the same kind of thing. I mean, to be honest, what it is it feels like militance to me. And I think all militance is unhealthy, really, sort of as a general rule. Exactly what
Rachel
said.
Are you very militant about that position?
Very militant. Do not question me. I mean, the fact of the matter is I totally agree with Rachel. And I've said this about so many things. I think you've heard me say it a few times, Paul. You know, if it works for you, your teams, your clients and your business, and it really doesn't matter how you're achieving that success. It makes no difference. But just to put in a sort of different angle on the argument, it's only when I saw Rachel's sort of prep that got me thinking. It does have to be said that many of the people, you know, on podcasts like this or on stages speaking, they're kind of an older or, you know, more experienced standpoint. And I think, you know, I say this because I think it's really important to remember what it's like to be younger. So, you know, I remember when I was, you know, back in my, you know, 20 somethings and I was way more militant. I was doing my front end mostly, you know, and I was militant. I was militant about how it should be done and what's that. My heart was still in the same place. But only, you know, my experiences since then, specifically on exposure to the business side, really changed my viewpoint on that now. One of the things, you know, managing a team, you talk about the shaming. I think it's to do with maturity, really, irrelevant of age, maturity. So there was one instance at my company I worked at where we had we were running two code bases, well, a few actually, but the predominant ones were ColdFusion and Ruby. And early my time at this company, there was this silly little war between these two, you know, on the same team, the Ruby people shaming the ColdFusion people. And you know what? They defended themselves and retaliated. It was just silly. About 3 years on from that, we kind of switched things around, not with this in mind, but we just ended up with a team that I think most people would agree was sort of just more mature in general. Uh-huh. And I actually received a DM on Slack one day from someone that was there back in the day, in the war days, as it were, a ColdFusion guy. And he said, you're never going to guess what's just happened. He said that we're in a sprint and a Ruby dev has just run out of work. And he's just asked if there's any ColdFusion he can help with. Wow. And he was amazed at the change in sort of attitude. Now, all that had changed is the maturity. But kind of back to the point quickly about, you know, the fact that we have to remember that what we were like when we were younger, it kind of makes me think that completely agree with everything everyone says here. But I wonder if we kind of need to start, as well as raising the awareness about the shaming, maybe we need to sort of get better at appreciating, you know, what it's like to be less experienced and get better at communicating why we're saying it doesn't matter. You know, but we don't really speak up about that too much. I think we're just too busy saying it doesn't matter. But maybe we need to go into more detail about why and hopefully save some people some pain of learning. Because it took me a good, you know, good 10 years to learn that, really.
I can't remember what it's like being in my
20s. Yeah, it's getting that way. I mean, you know, there's a lot of good comes of being in an industry where someone who you know, like me, has been doing this for sort of 20 years. You know, I was speaking at a conference and one of the other speakers was actually the same school year as my daughter. So I've got a 19-year-old, you know, so I've got, there's another speaker at the conference who essentially, you know, I could be his mum, which, you know, did make me feel very old. But how cool is that? You know, how cool is that, that someone who is brand new to this, really, who's got completely different insights, who comes from a different generation, can be sort of contributing on the same level as someone very experienced. I think that is something very special about our industry.
Definitely.
But, you know, I think it's right that we do need to sort of, we need to find ways for the experience that those of us who've been through these things several times can bring. It doesn't look like we're trying to squash that and trying to squash that enthusiasm, because it isn't that.
And it's, there's a difference, isn't there, between being enthusiastic about a new platform and shaming somebody who isn't using that platform. That, for me, is what it comes down to.
Yeah. And then again, I think, you know, I think Sam's completely right. There is an element of just maturity here, that you realize how you're coming across. You know, because I think when you actually talk to people face to face, they're like, oh, no, I didn't mean it like that at all, sort of thing, you know, because they didn't really. But they aren't aware that sort of pointing the finger at someone and saying, oh, you know, why are you using this crufty old thing? It's sort of showing, you know, it's sort of their own biases and the fact that perhaps, you know, they haven't been exposed to well-written PHP, for example. I mean, that's often a lot of what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's just, yeah, you get better at that as you get older. You get better at having those conversations.
I think the other thing that comes with age, or no, not age, experience, that the is that you pass through a lot of these stages. You know, I can look back over the years that I've been doing this, and I can see, you know, Cold Fusion come and go. I've seen Flash come and go. I've seen all of these different things coming up. And you know, the truth is, if you're a good developer, you know, you will adapt and you will evolve. And so, yes, the language doesn't matter as much because it will change. It's inevitable it's going to change. But the question, I think what people get hung up on and debate is when you should change. And that we've all got to jump at exactly the same moment and in exactly the same direction. And that's never going to happen. It's going to be more organic than that. You know, and that's fine.
And it's going to be different depending on the project, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're handing over, you know, we used to do PHP for clients when we did client work. And a lot of the time, PHP was the sensible choice because it was kind of easy to hand over to them. It would run, you know, without too much care and feeding on their servers, without having to have a very expensive stack. They could find new developers for it, which was really quite important to a lot of people. Yeah. You know, they wanted something that they could, you know, in the future find another developer. They wouldn't be too expensive. They'd know the technology. Now, if you're doing an in-house thing, if you're building your own product and it's going to be hosted on your servers, you've got a completely different situation there. You might have a bunch of developers who are really, really keen to all work in Node. Well, great. Why not? You know, if that works for what you're trying to build. So a lot of the time, it's not even about what you like, it's about what works best for the things that you're building and the clients you're serving.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, we need to wrap up at this point. We're not going to talk about my exciting topic, which would have been, of course, by far the best topic that was going to be covered, but you'll never know. So there you go. We'll talk about it next week instead. That's fine. We're just going to talk about our second sponsor. I should just say before that, I think when I talked about Mighty Deals earlier, I may have forgotten to mention their URL, which is fairly fundamental. So it's mightydeals.com. And that coupon code again was BOAGWORLD15 for 15% off of all their deals. But I do want to talk about our other sponsor who's sponsoring the whole season, which is really great of them. They're called VideoBlocks, and it's basically an affordable subscription-based stock media site for video material, which gives you unlimited access to premium stock footage, which I'm doing more and more video these days, and I know a lot of people are as well. And I recently wrote a blog post about how we need to be including more video in the stuff that we're doing. And so you know, a site like this is absolutely invaluable for adding footage into that kind of thing. You can get unlimited daily downloads from a library of 115,000 video clips, After Effects templates, motion backgrounds, and so much more. And it's all just there that you can use it. Your average subscriber ends up paying about less than $1 per download over the course of a year, because they make so much use of all this material. Because once it's there, you help yourself to it and use it loads. And I've been using it loads, found it really, really useful for the videos I've been creating. Videoblocks are offering BOAG World listeners a year subscription for $99 US dollars. That's a $50 discount over the usual price tag, which is brilliant, and less than $10 a month to access all of that amazing video footage. To get that year's subscription for only $99, then go to videoblocks.com/BOAG World. So that's videoblocks, VideoBlocks spelt correctly, not some weird internet spelling, /BOAG World, to get that discount offer. Cool. So that is basically it for our sponsors and it for our discussion. I hope you've enjoyed the kind of new format. I think it's really interesting. We're probably trying to cover too many things in each show, so we might have to adapt that in future, which is fine. But we ought to end by finding out where we can find more information about each person. So I'm going to go around really fast and just say where they can go and find out more about you. Rachel, where can people find out more about you?
Rachelandrew.co.uk is my sort of blog and things. I'm at Rachelandrew on Twitter, and grabaperch.com is the product.
Cool. And Sam, what about you?
I'm at the sambarns.com and also on Twitter with the same, at the sambarns.
And Dan?
My No Divide is nodividestudio.com, and you can find me on Twitter as DE.
That's a very good Twitter ID you've got there.
It's handy.
You got in early, didn't you?
Well, I just spoke to somebody very nicely on the Twitter support line.
Oh, did you indeed? It's all who you know, isn't it? Marcus, are you on the internet anymore, or have you just got so old that you've given up?
I've gone back to notebooks, pencils, paper, that kind of thing. I very occasionally blog on the Headscape site, and occasionally on BOAG World as well, so headscape.co.uk, and I occasionally make an utterance on Twitter under Marcus67.
So there you go. And I presume that if you're listening to this podcast, you know who I am and where to find me. Unfortunately, we have to waste valuable podcast time now doing Marcus's joke.
Well, it's a very short joke, and it's one that Paul posted on the Slack channel. So,
oh, is it?
So blame him.
Damn.
Dogs cannot operate an MRI machine, but cats can.
See, that got a laugh. People laughed at that. I knew Sam would would approve of it, because Sam likes all things cats.
I do. That was good. I'll give you that one. Well done, Paul.
Thank you very much. So we'd be really interested to hear your feedback on this roundtable format, whether you like it, whether you find it useful, whether you'd like us to cover different things. If you've got a topic that you would like us to talk about, you can either tweet the person closest related to it that you've heard, or just use the hashtag 4BW with any suggestions you've got. But for now, thank you so much for listening, and thank you to my guests for joining me on this week's show. We'll be back again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.